I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a closer look at a story from Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. This week, President Donald Trump abruptly left the G7 summit in Canada for the Situation Room at the White House. That was amidst back-and-forth strikes between Iran and Israel. CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger said that the G7 is a moment where countries try to seal some deals on trade. And it ended with lots of uncertainty on many fronts, including Trump's ever-changing tariff landscape and this sudden emergence of another Middle East conflict. That conflict could also start to create inflation in the next few months and impact oil prices, but more on that later. As for what happened in the Middle East this week, the Associated Press reported that Israel stunned and hobbled Iran when it pulled off an intelligence and military operation that struck high-level targets. Israeli military quickly incapacitated many of Iran's air defenses and missile systems. They also bombarded key nuclear sites and killed top generals and scientists. But what will Iran do next? The eyes of the world are watching, as are the eyes of America's top leaders, who were holed up in that Situation Room. Reuters reported that while Israel struck decisive blows against Iran, it will struggle to deal a knockout to Iran's nuclear sites without the U.S. joining the attack. It would need the U.S. to join with strategic bombers that can penetrate deep underground. Vice President J.D. Vance said that Trump could order the U.S. military into the Israel-Iran fight if Tehran doesn't agree to give up its nuclear enrichment program. The specter of the United States being suddenly enmeshed in fighting in the Middle East is terrifying to many Americans. So here's more on Iran and Israel and what happened at the G7 summit from Odyssey in the Bay Area with political analyst Mark Sandilow.
Mark, what sort of leverage does the president have in trying to negotiate a deal between these two countries?
Enormous leverage, Eric. I mean, the United States both has the military capability to take out Iran's nuclear capabilities. They got these bunker-busting bombs that Israel does not have in the same capacity. So if they wanted to help Israel, they could drop some bombs on Iran that would set them back years and years in terms of enriching uranium and creating a nuclear bomb. They also have enormous sway over Israel. Netanyahu can talk tough, but the fact is the United States sends Israel tens of billions of dollars worth of, you know, military aid every year. So the president's in a unique position to force the two of them either to the negotiating table, to have some sort of truce. This is a big moment. I mean, not just for Donald Trump, it's a big moment for the Middle East and for world peace, because Trump has a really tough decision here. Does he support Israel all out and go after Iran as he suggests he might be interested in doing? Does he at the same time force him to the negotiating table? Does he pull back, as a lot of his own MAGA supporters are urging the president to do, and say, look, this is not the United States war. Iran may be a threat to Israel. It's not a threat to the United States. We shouldn't get involved. So whatever the president is deciding over the course of, you know, these several hours is very, very consequential.
How likely is it that U.S. troops would get involved?
Troops seem almost out of the question, Margie, although who knows at this point. It's really a matter of U.S. technology. It's bunker-busting bombs. I mean, the United States has all sorts of military capabilities. It wouldn't necessarily mean putting troops on the ground. As just heard in the CBS update, I think that there is a lot of hope among the anti-Iran people right now, the anti-Iran government, that the instability caused right now would cause some sort of revolution there, and there'd be a change in government, and that it would become again a more democratic country. But, you know, you can't force that on anybody. Interestingly, the president, who was obsessed with this with his social media, you know, last night he told people to evacuate big cities because he didn't want people to get hurt if Iran gets bombed. This morning he also had something, but I was just checking. In the last 20 minutes, he seems to be back on immigration. So who knows if he's still in the Situation Room or exactly what's happening right now, because there's no public appearances scheduled.
Yeah, in the past, if the U.S. was going to get involved militarily, most presidents will go to Congress and ask, may I? What do you think the chances are here? And I'm not talking about boots on the ground, because like you, I think that's unlikely. But air attacks, those are possible.
Yes, and Eric, I mean, I think that the answer is the chances that he goes to Congress to get advice is virtually none. I mean, he's done that for none of his domestic policy. He's done stuff by executive authority. I don't think there's any question that the commander-in-chief has the authority to authorize the U.S. military to be used, at least in a limited way, going to war. I mean, the Constitution says that Congress has a right to declare war. But, you know, that's why for decades the United States wasn't at war in Vietnam. We were just having a military exercise because Congress had not declared war in Vietnam. So there are ways around that. I think that the idea, it'd be very interesting to hear who the president is listening to right now. Congress, you know, I would doubt very much. He even just sent out, he told reporters last night that Tulsi Gabbard, his head of intelligence, has said that Iran is not building a nuclear bomb. He said to reporters last night, he doesn't really care what she thinks.
Here at home, tensions in the Middle East, particularly between Iran and Israel, could impact oil and gas prices. But there are factors that help buffer the U.S. economy from that tumult. Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, joined the Newell Norman Show at Odyssey in New Orleans to discuss further.
The good thing is, as you look around the globe, there's a time of increasing tension. Russia's not backing off of Ukraine. We have the horrible situation in the Middle East. And I think that the G7 leaders are seriously going to get together and say, look, we have a lot of very serious problems. Tariffs are not the biggest thing in the world. And let's reach a deal that makes sense. And I believe that there's going to be a lot of momentum in that direction. You've seen the president and his advisors say what we want to do is get to a fair trade where we have open access to markets. And I'm very optimistic that that actually may occur this time because, you know, the challenge of all the different things that are going on in the world will focus the world leaders on things that make economic sense going forward.
Yeah, it's I think it's going to be interesting on a number of fronts. Even though because of the friction with Canada, I find it a little strange that these non-G7 members have been invited. It's almost as if there's maybe a desire to put them all in. Do you think they get all in the same room together at some point?
I think there is, but there's also a global thing where you step back and say, you know, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea are trying to create an axis of power that's really antithetical democracy. And when you look around and you get the G7 plus the invited guest, our friends are better than their friends. So I think there's a recognition that we have a lot of shared values. You know, we believe in democratic elections. And, you know, a wonderful thing is you get to pick your leaders in all the countries that we've invited to the G7. So you leave out Russia, which doesn't deserve to be included. China is a mess right now. So I think there is a feeling that this is a time for us to come together and see what we can do to make the global economy work well for everybody.
I know we're going to be talking about inflation here shortly, but I'm kind of curious, state of the tariffs at the present time, what impact on our local economy, on our national economy, I mean?
Well, you know, the tariffs go back and forth. There is an economic theory, and it goes back to the 40s and 50s, that a low tariff rate between 10 and 20% executed by a big economy like the U.S., most of the cost would be borne by the exporters. So if we settle in the range of 10%, you know, no more than 20, it may not be horrible for the U.S. economy. One of the challenges that we've dealt with in this tariff discussion is people have looked at, well, the tariffs are just going to increase cost, and automatically every bit of the tariff will be passed on to consumers. Well, it's not the case. Some is absorbed by the exporters, some is absorbed by the companies. And then the consumer doesn't sit still. Consumers have choices, and people have forgotten the substitution effect. If it turns out that French wine is very expensive, then people start looking and saying, okay, well, let's look at American vintages. Let's look at things from other regions. And the substitution effect is keeping inflation down, and it's having a real effect on the tariff inflation that everybody expected. So I think this combined with the idea of the tariffs, it looks now we're more a gambit. You know, we'll propose a maximalist tariff and then negotiate down from open markets where we have lower tariffs and we have open access to those markets. If that's where we end up, that actually wouldn't be a bad solution for everybody.
And the methodology that's been deployed by Trump has come under significant criticism. Is there a good way to try and drive and re-engineer the structure of these deals? I mean, it almost seems to me that you almost have to approach this in an unconventional way, because people just aren't willing, unless there's certain friction points, leverage points that folks have, they're not really too willing to listen, right? I mean, we've not seen these types of significant changes in quite a long time.
No, you're right. And I think every country has its own internal dynamic of things that they can and can't do. One that we face in the U.S. is because we have elections every 2 and 4 years, you know, President Trump is term limited. So his feeling is whatever he needs to do, wants to do, has to be done fairly quickly. Midterm elections are around the corner. So he's under a time clock that other countries are not. Normally, trade deals take years to work out. Well, if it's a 2 or 3 year deal, from the president's perspective, he's out of office. And, you know, whatever happens is going to be after his term. So he's pushing hard to do it quickly. He's also, I think, this time listening to the Silicon Valley folks who have a theory of disruption. You know, break it, and then we'll fix it later. Whatever it is, just disrupt the system, and then we'll rebuild it. It's chaotic. It's challenging for our international partners because they operate on a longer time frame. And the European Union is a perfect example because they have to build consensus. Major deals have to be approved by all of the EU countries. So it literally can take years to make deals. A perfect example is the European Union is still negotiating with England over Brexit. And one of the sticking points is fishing rights. And fishing is a relatively small part of the economy of both the EU and England, but it's a sticking point for negotiations. So his plan is to disrupt and then get to a negotiated solution. If you're a diplomat, it's a little hard and it's a little disruptive. I can't say what's right or wrong, but you just have to recognize the dynamic is driven by the term limits that we have in the U.S. and the fact that trade deals are normally years in the making. And he's trying to push a process that is normally very slow and make it a very fast process. And that's a challenge. It's like trying to turn around a supertanker.
I'm getting some texts, Guy. People are saying that that's, you know, no way does an exporter absorb tariffs. We've been in the 10 to 20% tariff range for quite a long period of time, all through the first Trump years, Trump administration, through the Biden administration as well. A lot of the Trump tariffs were kept in place during the Biden administration. And we know with the recent data that exporters were, in fact, absorbing the tariff rate, right?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people tend to overlook is it depends. And I know economists love to say it depends, but it does. If you have no alternative supply, and we use a silly example. If you want a McLaren supercar, McLaren has said, this is the price we want in euros. We could care less what the tariff rate is, what the terms are. We still want this net price. So if you want a McLaren, you have to pay that price. On right. the other hand, a commodity that has substitutes where other countries can produce it, where you don't really need to buy it, the product may be something that you can buy from Asia, can buy from Central America, then the shipper does have to absorb it. And the simple example of that is fast fashion. The companies Temu and Shein sold extremely cheap fast fashion to American consumers, and particularly younger adults love that because you could have a whole wardrobe for a small price. They had big profit margins, 30-35%. They can afford to absorb a 10% tariff, and in some cases did, in order to keep their volume up. So depending on the product, the exporter may absorb it. If it's a product that you really want with no substitutes, then the exporter is not going to absorb it. The other thing is, on the consuming side, do you have an option? If you don't have to buy it and the price goes up a lot, you may choose to substitute something else. And that's what we're seeing right now, is a lot of consumers are saying, I don't want to buy that, but I'll buy something different.
Yeah, it's and I'm glad you made that distinction. It just simply all depends. And you need to stay in the game. You need to stay competitive. And sometimes you do these things contrary to sound business interests in order to do so, right?
Well, and a simple example is Costco has their famous hot dog and a drink special. They're not making money selling hot dogs at Costco, but they don't care. They're making right. money selling everything else. So when you go in and you get the hot dog and a drink special, then you buy the other things that Costco does make money on. And look, the importers are constantly looking for other sources. That's the beauty of the free market. If one company and one country becomes expensive, you start shopping for alternatives. And so that's going to ameliorate a lot of the tariffs. But you can't say simplistically that the exporter will absorb it all, because in some cases they will and some they won't. And you can't say it'll all pass on automatically as a price increase, because that's not true either. It's a much more complex equation than that. We still don't know. One of the things that helped inflation last month is lower energy prices. And the instability between Israel and Iran could push energy prices up. But for the U.S., it is not as bad as other countries, because we're essentially energy independent. We do import some oil, but we export a lot more. And we have the ability to produce all that we need right here. So we're not expecting a tremendous surge in energy prices. Toward the end of the week when the conflict broke out, Brent crude went up about $10 a barrel, but then it came back down over the weekend. And so it's trading in the 70s, which is still lower than it was a few years ago. So right now, energy was a deflationary force last month. It probably won't be deflationary going forward, but unless something gets much worse, it doesn't look like the energy price is going to explode up. And the U.S. does have the ability to produce more. One of the things that's going on in Iran is that there is a big export terminal, and Israel has not attacked that. If Israel wanted to, they could destroy Iran's ability to export oil. And for their own purposes, they've chosen not to do so. Now, does that change going forward? Who knows? But right now, Iran still has the ability to export oil, so they have not closed the Strait of Hormuz. Their big export island is still intact, and I have no idea how this conflict ends. I just hope that it'll end fairly quickly.
Well, if you don't control the sky, you don't control your destiny as it relates to any of that. And that I'm sure is going to be a huge leverage point and consideration as to why Iran may be sending overtures that they want to get back to the negotiating table, right?
Yeah, they are. And it was interesting. BBC World News had a comment over the weekend. They said Israel has achieved something that Russia could not achieve, which is domination in the sky. So Russia still doesn't dominate the sky in Ukraine, and the Ukrainians have been able to push the Russian Air Force further and further back from the front lines. What happens when you dominate the sky is you no longer have to use your stealth planes and your super war planes. You can use your older inventory and fly closer to your targets, and it becomes much more of an operational task that can be planned if the opposition can't shoot down your war planes. And it looks like Israel's getting to that point in Iran. They've been able to degrade the air defenses. And able to pretty much attack where they want. So it may be one of the reasons that Iran would like to get back to the negotiating table. And, you know, if a real solution could be negotiated with an end to their nuclear threat, I think that'd be wonderful for the whole world and for the Middle East.
So the $52 million question is, how is the Federal Reserve consuming this information, and what's their outlook?
Yeah, but what the Fed is looking at is stay where you are. I mean, they're not seeing anything that makes them need to cut right now. Inflation seems to be coming down. Their models still show that if the tariffs continue, it might push up consumer prices. They haven't yet, but the Fed's models say they might in the future. Unemployment is still relatively low, and the Fed has a dual mandate. They want to keep unemployment low. They want to keep inflation low. Well, it looks like inflation is tracking where it needs to. Unemployment is pretty stable where it is. The only challenge is new graduates are having a little bit harder time getting jobs this year than last. So the Fed looks at this and says, well, if the Middle East blows up and oil prices go up a lot, then inflation could come back, and that would be a reason not to cut rates right now. If that Middle East conflict is resolved, it may be that we're in a position that in September we could start with rate cuts.
Eric Smith, a professor at Tulane Institute of Energy, joined Tommy Tucker at WWL for more on the financial implications of the escalation between Israel and Iran.
First of all, you know, I was thinking in advance of your coming on, and my age is a closely kept secret, but maybe I did, maybe I didn't, live through the oil shortage of the 70s where you couldn't get gas. And if you were a teenager trying to date at that time and you couldn't get gas, that was a big deal. So maybe I'm not as concerned with the price of gas as I am the availability of it, as some people are, because they haven't lived through not having gas and having to go through gas rationing and shortages and that kind of thing. With all that being said, tell me what this whole thing with Iran could mean for oil and gas prices.
Well, I think it kind of echoes your experience. It's not price sensitive in our normal thinking. I mean, but the only estimate I've seen, someone said that if you were to close the Straits of Hormuz, which controls about a third of the oil traffic in the world for exported oil, if you were to close that, the price would jump from $72 to something like $120 a barrel, which sounds pretty bad unless you can't get it at all. And, of course, we don't import a lot of oil from the Middle East, but the rest of the world does. And as I've said before, if you have a shortage anywhere in the world, the price of oil tends to climb for everybody, including the U.S. And we do import, as you know, heavy oil to be able to run our refineries here in Louisiana. So it could be bad, but I don't think we're going to run out of fuel. And if you were still dating and trying to keep body and soul together, you would still be able to buy fuel in Louisiana.
But you know, it is interesting if you think about it through that context. A lot of people don't remember that, what it was like to not, no matter how much you wanted it, you couldn't get it. It was odd and even license plate numbers. You'd sit in line and then be no gas. It'd be 5 gallons here or there, the other thing. And I think people kind of forgot about that. You?
Yeah, I think so. I was living up in New York at the time and trying to keep a Porsche running, and it was not the easiest thing in the world because it only ran on, you know, high-octane gasoline. So I finally figured out a way to buy fuel down at the marine dock and run the car on that, but it wasn't easy.
So who controls the Strait of Hormuz right now?
Well, we do, kind of. We've got a whole fleet sitting right at the mouth of it, designed to keep anybody from closing it. Of course, the Iranians periodically threaten to close it. But we keep it open, not so much because we need the oil that comes out of the Middle East, but the rest of the world does, both Eastern and Western. And when you think about it, even people like Russia, who are not our friends these days, are dependent on oil moving out of the Middle East and their products moving into the Middle East. So to the degree that people can all agree on one thing, it's keep the Straits of Hormuz open.
And
so
the problem,
that's one of the things that's likely to be a flashpoint.
Because
and the
again,
other one on the other side is the Bab al-Mandab, which is the equivalent one on the Horn of Africa side. So, again, it's a very narrow passage, and all of the oil that comes out of the western side of Saudi Arabia exits through that strait. So it's another flashpoint.
So I guess the question is, how concerned are you, or how concerned should Americans be about the availability, perhaps, but price of oil or gas going up, gasoline?
Well, I hearken back to what you said earlier. People are going to be upset, and particularly the president's going to be upset if oil prices start to escalate rapidly. He's a firm believer in the idea that low oil prices mean votes. And he's got his two-year, congressional elections coming up, so he's going to try and keep that as low as possible. I think the things to focus on are what the Israelis are doing and the responses by the Iranians, because I think that's where we have the potential for the most damage, if you will, to being incrementally drawn into something. Every one of our big wars didn't just spring up overnight. There were things that we were making adjustments and what we thought were relatively minor changes. And some of these changes are pretty major, like whole task forces being sent to the Middle East and the Eastern Med. But, you know, there are some things that could trigger if we were to decide, for example, to release the so-called bunker buster bombs that the Israelis would like to use on the Iranian fuel enrichment facilities that are all underground. That would be considered an escalation by the Iranians, and they would do something about it, like shooting at one of our aircraft carriers or something. You could worry about things like there are something like 600,000 U.S. citizens that live in Israel, and you start killing off U.S. citizens or damaging American ships. People tend to get pretty emotional about that sort of thing.
So bottom line, before we let you go, scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you of this escalating into something major?
If my normal course would be a 5, this is like raising things to a 7, but not to a 10.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of On Deadline. It's produced by me, Lauren Berry, and by Christy Strauser. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to stay informed.